The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Okay, hello and welcome back to Millennial. Hold on a second, I think we've got technical problems here.
Okay.
That was bizarre. Okay, I think we're back. Okay, my apologies, I'm still learning how to do this with the multiple platforms.
That was bizarre.
What the hell is going on? All right. Sorry, everyone. Okay. So Apostolic Majesty was on Millennial 2 years ago, and that was a very well-received stream. So I wanted to have him on again to, well, discuss events this year, which are obviously the coronation of Charles III, King Charles III. And what that means for the British monarchy. So, Apostolic Majesty, welcome back to Millennial.
No, it's a pleasure to come back on as a rather dejected and defeated royalist who also happens to be a YouTube historian. So, thank you very much for having me back on.
Well, I've described you as an English historian and content creator because you obviously have your own YouTube channel. But it's the heavy emphasis on history and British history particularly. So how would you characterise the British monarchy? And I should say that this stream is going to be very much about the constitution of Britain and the royal family and so forth, and the concept of monarchy. So if that's not your kind of thing, this stream won't be for you. But I wanted to talk about it because obviously it's become very relevant, what with the death of Queen Elizabeth II, and now this new king, who is very different. We can obviously talk about that. It's brought it all back into people's minds that Britain is a constitutional monarchy, and there's all the pageantry, there's all the ceremony and history associated with that. And to see the crowds earlier this year, at the funeral and then at the coronation, you see what it means to be. There's still a huge segment of the British population, and even the Scottish population, for whom the royal family and is very meaningful, and maybe the institution of monarchy is very meaningful. So we talk about democracy all the time, but, well, what would you say about this?
Well, when you first contacted me regarding this topic, you described the passage of time from Charles I to Charles III as the defenestration of monarchy. And I found that a very interesting term because, of course, defenestration, I instantly think of a weird sort of a bohemian defenestrations on, it just so happens, Charles Square in the 15th and the 16th centuries. I think my preferred word will be despoliation. A institution which withers, and with every iteration, something is taken away. I think the problem when I encounter this topic of monarchy is that, contrary to a lot of people's expectations, I operate entirely without sentiment. So I don't necessarily have this rosy-eyed view in terms of the institution, partly because I have a, you can say, a rather morbid understanding of history. It's just a series of protracted defeats, one after another, and the instance of the monarchy is no different, I'm afraid, just by way of an introduction.
Yeah, it's an institution that, like any other, can go rotten, and with time, inevitably, eventually does. I don't mean to be fatalistic, but I just think that, being realistic, anything everything eventually passes away from vitality to towards decadence and eventual disintegration. In the case of the monarchy, it's not disintegrated. It's become a sort of pastiche of itself. Why don't you bring us back? I should say the phrase that I sent you, I think that was based on something you'd said on one of Academic Agent streams. There was some reason why I sent, why I came up with that, why I sent that to you. So let's talk about what the monarchy, the English British monarchy, has been. Well, let's talk about it from Charles I. I think from Charles I to Charles III is a good scope for us to have. So why don't you describe the monarchy in Britain at that time?
Okay, well, I think I'll start with a couple of things regarding what the monarchy is now and what the monarchy was. When Charles III became king, I was, first of all, interested in the idea of ethnocentrism, who he was going to be a monarch to. I was also interested in the idea of the of this whole notion of defender of the faith versus defender of the faiths, whereby we take a multi-faith understanding of what it means to be have monarchical protection. And then there is, of course, the aspect of personal rule, to what extent Charles would rule as a monarch. Many people were going around saying that the issue regarding Queen Elizabeth II is that being a obviously a queen, she couldn't exert a kingly monarchical presence and embody, you can say, some sort of masculinity regarding the institution, which I think is a very flawed estimation, but whatever. When you come back to someone like Charles I, Charles I is the penultimate monarch who was able to wield personal power, and he also attempted to bring the nation into a collective understanding of what the true Anglican Reformed faith was going to be. And in both these endeavors, he failed spectacularly, no matter what my personal interest is in what he attempted to do. And since the not only the deposition, but also the regicide, the killing, the beheading of Charles I, and the creation of the Republic under Cromwell, a lot of constitutional historians tend to de-emphasize the role of the monarchy. Instead, they go towards this idea of the crown in Parliament. In many ways, it represents the idea that Parliament is sovereign, and the monarchy simply wields executive power. You can almost say indirectly, through the institution of Parliament, where the government is represented among the House of Commons and the House of Lords. In that sense, you can say that after Charles II and James II, with the Dutch coup in 1688, when the William III came to power as a result of an invitation by a series of traitors, both Tories and Whigs, that ever since then, Britain has been a Whig republic. And of course, Whig in turn turns to Liberal, and Liberal in turn turns to Democrat. And Democrat in turn really means deracinated internationalist, is where we've arrived at now.
Yeah, I was going to, I thought you were going to go from Whig to Liberal to Progressive, which would be another, another way to characterize it.
I think the issue with that is I believe progressive is inherent in all of these things.
Right, yes. But of course, what we have now, that the progressive of today is a demented nihilist, the stereotypical SJW. I think it's interesting, actually, because nowadays the British Empire is talked about as a deeply racist, white supremacist thing. But it was actually more of a liberal project at the time than a conservative one, because of the conservatism meant something very different back then. Would you like to go into that?
Yes, I've been thinking about the British Empire a lot recently. And what I find fascinating about the British Empire is that it's an institution which was, you can say, founded when Henry VIII declared himself the supreme governor over religion in the country, the supreme governor of the Church of England, which was an admonition against the then empires, which were the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire. So Britain began, or rather England, began as an empire but it began as an empire against empire, if that makes any sense. But it was done so under a strong monarch, and the strong monarch figure continued until the 17th century. But when England and later Great Britain after 1707 began colonizing places, these places did not become economically productive, especially in the 16th century, 17th century, bastions of the empire and bastions of royalism. Instead, they were a amalgamation of various sort of disaffected religious groups, from Catholics to Quakers. And they all had this understanding of English liberty, the foundational ideas of some sort of independence from the king founded in Magna Carta, even though I would actually say Magna Carta is a bit of a misnomer in terms of understanding this trajectory and go back further before 1066 and before Magna Carta to the coronation oaths. But all I'm trying to emphasize here is that with the creation of a British Empire, we do not see an empire in terms of one figure exerting power throughout all of these dominions, but rather we have a loose amalgamation. In fact, whenever a monarch tries to exercise Caesarian power, like Charles II or even George III, it tends to be defeated and it tends to result in a further unraveling of the empire, a process of decentralization. So you can say in many ways that the project of monarchy was on a collision course with the project of the British Empire. And when the British Empire was created, it was fundamentally a republican institution. And what do I mean by that? Because I think a lot of people are going to be very confused when I say that. I have very specific intentions when I describe words. When I refer to monarchy, I don't refer to them being a person who is called a king. I refer to it as monarch, rule of one, i.e. someone who actually wields executive power by personal fiat. You can call them despots, you can call them autocrats, it really doesn't, or absolute monarchs, it really doesn't matter. The point is, that is how monarchy was defined originally, and that is how I believe people should understand monarchy today. Royalism is something quite different. Versus that concept, you have the idea of republic, res publica, which means a popular affair or popular thing, which essentially means that there is a power-sharing agreement between a lot of different factions. You can say this is the origin of the rather misguided concept of separation of powers. The idea, of course, is inherited from Rome. And why I think it's so appropriate for the British Empire is that after 1688, the monarchy, in terms of becoming a republic, becomes this loose amalgamation of aristocrats, traders, bankers, bishops, all operating across the span of the British Empire. Then in the late 18th century, you have merchant companies, you have generals such as Clive. All of these figures made up the republican character that was the British Empire. And you mentioned earlier the idea of monarchy as pastiche. Well, what is monarchy in the whole scheme of things? Well, monarchy increasingly becomes an ornament. And as I mentioned, whenever a monarch tries to actually exert control over the colonies, like George III, it tends to have disastrous ramifications. So this is why I believe there's such a misunderstanding when it comes to the British Empire and when it comes to monarchy. In many ways, this again may sound rather bizarre, but I would say that America was far more successful as a monarchical state than the British Empire ever was. So in terms of basically understanding what the British monarchy is, I mean, I could almost see it as a massive failure in many ways. The British monarchy failed in terms of being able to bring about the Anglican Reformation because the British monarchy was never able to establish a single confession of faith that was adopted by everyone. And the monarchy ultimately lost control of the institutions it created. Parliament was, as we currently sort of know it, was established by Edward I around the turn of the 14th century. And it was designed as a way of augmenting royal power. It was designed as a way of regulating royal justice, a process which had already begun in France. But in many ways, Edward I innovated in a way which is unseen in Europe at that time. So all of these factors, you could say, should have augmented royal power. But the monarch was captured by Parliament and the monarch was ultimately captured by his own reformed confession, which is what happened in 1688. The monarch is no longer able to determine the religion of his land. Instead, he has become essentially beholden to Parliament, parliament that will determine not only what the religion is, but what king accurately practices their interpretation of the religion, which is why we have things like the Jacobite rebellion, the old pretender, James III, the deposition of James II, and the imposition of the foreign Hanoverian dynasty in the 17th century. Why Charles I is very interesting in terms of giving this a broader historical perspective is that Charles I represented the antithesis of all these things. He represented an attempt to create a personal great British monarchy, which was the inheritance of his father. He attempted to create a uniformed religious confession, and he attempted to dominate Parliament, which is why he dissolved it and established his own system of personal rule. And in many ways, I would say he actually exemplified the English mode of governing, because because he lacked parliamentary authority, England became a demobilized state. It was very weak militarily. It was peaceful. And you can say that represents a return to some form of English exceptionalism or isolationism. But when Cromwell comes to power, Cromwell, the republican monarch, the monarch of the Commonwealth, completely redefines what Britain is, establishes a military dictatorship, goes on, conquers Ireland, goes on and conquers the West Indies. So all of these competing notions of monarchy exist in our history. But from 1688, I very much believe that, as you mentioned, the monarchy does become pastiche. It becomes weaker with every iteration, with every monarch. George I is weaker than Anne. George IV is weaker than George III. Victoria is weaker than William IV. And it just goes on. You can
until you end up with Harry and Meghan, which is so, it's laughable. It's just ludicrous, really, to think of those as, I know that he's not the monarch, obviously, but the point is that the monarch, the king, is associated with this nonsense, just like his mother, unfortunately, was associated with this nonsense.
I think that's very interesting, because you bring up the point earlier about the British Empire being lambasted as a racist institution. Well, we have Prince Harry basically accepting that line and declaring to all the world that not only does the British Empire have a history of racism, but the royal family as an institution is itself institutionally racist. So the fact that this comes from a person who originally held the title of His Royal Highness should again emphasize the utter degeneration of the system. And I have to actually say that Prince William is not much better. I tend to view William, unfortunately, as an empty skull for which the winds of time just sort of whistle through the empty eye sockets.
Oh, dear. That is a shame. But Harry, we're jumping ahead in the chronology here, but I will say that I don't think any single person could personify castration more than he does, because he's castrated as a husband, he's castrated as a prince, he's castrated as a public figure, he's humiliated as a public figure. And as a representative of his country, he's as you say, he's demonizing his own country's history. He's everything that he could be expected to protect and stand for, he has forsaken. And it's really remarkable when you think about it in those terms. He's thrown away so much, and not just his royal title, but the respect of the public. He's rubbished the institution. He's humiliated his family. He's insulted his country and the public. And as I say, he's demonized his country's history. It's astonishing.
Despoliation becomes castration.
Yes. Yeah. It's like that institution, the fate of the institution is personified in Harry. It's grim.
I think I would push back a little bit there. I very much think that Harry is an extreme outlier. He hasn't done the monarchy any sort of benefit, but I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, as strange as that may seem.
Okay.
Well, I'll explain what I mean. When I look at the monarchy, you mentioned the sentimental attachment that it has. And like I said, I'm a figure very much divorced from any sentimental attachment. I tend to look at the institution as is and see what it could be and what it historically was. I think because I don't look at things through the vein of presentism, I tend to view it within the historical context. It gives me a rather sort of, I hate to say this, not deracinated in terms of space, but deracinated in terms of the time I live in. So when looking at someone like Harry, I think, again, Harry is simply indicative of a figure of his time. But regarding the monarchy, he is a liability, but not necessarily in the way that you think it is. The fact that the monarchy puts on a air of respectability, which was very much the legacy of Elizabeth II, is, to people like you and me, I would say actually a disadvantage. My view of Elizabeth II is that she was a progressive ally. I don't put the blame on Elizabeth II. I believe that this actually started a long time before her. I mean, we mentioned the general decline of the monarchy, but the complete freefall began with her grandfather, George V, because George V really inaugurated the modern British political system. I mean, you use constitutional monarchy. I tend to, again, push back against that word simply because it's nebulous, it's interchangeable, and it has sort of no commonly understood meaning beyond the idea that a monarch has to be tempered in some way. Well, yeah. I tend to view all monarchs are tempered throughout their entire history, and even autocracies have some constitutional autocracies have some sort of constitutional vestments. But what George V did is that George V ushered in a aggressive system of democratization, which was his actions during David Lloyd George's attempt to pass a people's budget, which were radical in the sense of completely redefining the relationship between what was effectively a very libertarian and retrenched economic and political system. And by that, I mean low spending compared to the origins essentially of what would later become the welfare state and mass British statism from the 1940s until the 1970s. And worse than that, he did it through the democratic mechanism to destroy the power of the House of Lords and actually destroy the United Kingdom itself indirectly by allowing the Irish Home Rule Party to come into power. In terms of establishing the monarchy, therefore, not just as a as basically a fellow traveller, but an instigator, an accelerator when it comes to the, you can say, the elimination of sort of a British tradition, I look to George V. And this is all the more remarkable because given everything that's been written about him, given the manner in which he basically conveyed his style of monarchy, his complete lack of charisma, etc., no one would assume that a figure like that was capable of such a revolution of the institution, but he was. And he went beyond that. I believe he was the figure most responsible for condemning the Russian royal family to death by banning them from being allowed to come in this country. It wasn't David Lloyd George, it was the king. He changed the name of the dynasty from the House of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha to the House of Windsor, which again was a cosmetic affectation to give the monarchy some sort of kitsch sense of Englishness, which I think again has gone down very well. But when I look at sort of monarchy merchandising and I look at all those people sort of getting overly excited when it comes to the coronation, etc., or royal wedding, I get Kadinka vibes. The Kadinka tragedy in 1896 was accompanying the coronation of Tsar Nicholas II, the last Tsar, who was essentially considered by himself as Job the long-suffering, Job the cursed, the man who would ultimately bring an end to the Russian monarchy. There was a conscious fatalism about Nicholas II, and it begins with the tragedy.
Sorry, go on.
And it begins with the tragedy of the Kadinka field, because whilst all these patriotic Tsarist Russians off trying to get free souvenirs which have been offered on the day, it causes a stampede and they are all crushed in the process. Many thousands died. And I think the royal sort of kitsch, the pastiche elements of the monarchy, are in many ways just as damaging as aspects of the Kadinka tragedy.
Do you think it degrades people?
I don't think it degrades people. I think it gives them a false sense of attachment to an institution which isn't there for them.
Right.
One of the things I've really been trying to understand about Charles is really what he represents. And this is also a failing on my part, which is I tend to assign far more sort of intellectual reasons or sort of justifications to people than is perhaps deserved. in other words, I over-intellectualize. You can almost say I have a rather pretentious way of understanding history by finding all of these obscure contexts. I'll freely admit that. I'm not above sort of a bit of self-awareness there. But my but my observation back when it came to the coronation, because many people were saying, oh, look, Charles has read René Guénon. You know, he's based, he's perennialist, you know, he's probably read Evola, etc., etc. He's going to come back, he's going to dissolve Parliament, you know, he's going to start a civil war with the Americans and things like that. And I mean, obviously that was ridiculous, but it was sort of fun to entertain these fantasies at the time. When it came to the coronation, I looked at it as basically representing a form of Mughalism. The Mughals were a Indian dynasty who were ethnically from Central Asia. They were the descendants of the great conqueror Tamerlane. And under Akbar, they had attempted to synthesize all the religions of the empire, the Jains, the Muslims, the Hindus, even Jesuits were sort of introduced into this idea where the monarch essentially became God. And when Charles, you know, is attached to these ideas of like defenders of the faith, I wonder, okay, is he trying to do that? Is he trying to amalgamate all of these diverse, disparate religious elements and synthesize them into his own conception of monarchy? And I think Justin Welby is just as awful in terms of being able to understand this as he is, because you have the coronation oath, which is there to defend the reformed faith, which is the legacy of what I brought up earlier, the 1688 Dutch coup. But of course, you can't change that without an act of parliament. So they got away with that by basically prefacing the whole thing in saying that we who respect a community of all faiths, i.e. we are going to defend the reformed religion, but not really, is the proviso. We have to legally say this, but the whole spirit of the thing sort of reviles against it. And when it comes to the actual coronation itself, the coronation is basically an imitation of transubstantiation. Transubstantiation in the Catholic Mass is about transforming the body, the bread and the wine into the body and blood of Christ. It is basically the representation of the host as is, unlike in the Protestant iteration where it's supposed to represent or signify as opposed to truly embody. The interesting thing about this, of course, is that it's a Protestant ceremony. So the anointing doesn't have any inherent magical sort of power to it. And yet the whole coronation ceremony, as indicative of England's peculiar reformation, is supposed to signify this act of sort of transubstantiation. None of these sort of religious ceremonies, even if you go to Orthodox ceremonies like the coronation of a czar, or you go to Catholic ceremonies, the whole aspect of sacramentality is even very contentious in non-Protestant, Catholic and Orthodox religions. But the illusion is there. And I think the illusion is to give the covenantal conception of kingship, that the king is bestowed by a power or a trust by God, some sort of sacred aura, albeit the intrinsic meaning is not really there. When I watched that, I had a strong iconoclastic impulse. I felt very Cromwellian. And the reason I felt Cromwellian is because, is this all pomp and ceremony, all sound and fury that signifies nothing? And is this like the kitsch, like the memorabilia offered at Cadinga Field? Is this all in service of something which is actually antithetical to all that is meant to be represented here?
Yes, and this is a scary thing because you've got all these crowds of people full of adulation and respect and veneration, I guess would be the word, for the figure of the monarch and the monarch to be, and for the institution, and you have to wonder, what does it all mean? Does that monarch give a toss about them, and does the institution give a toss about them? And if not, then what? See, this is a question that I wanted to ask you earlier, so I'll ask you now. You said that whenever a monarch has attempted Caesarism to executive control, it hasn't worked out. So what is the proper role for a British English monarch? Obviously, the public have huge affection. Even with all the claims about democracy and how much we value that, nevertheless, we still have tremendous affection for the monarch. So, and yet, when the monarch has attempted to exert control, that has backfired. So I guess the question is, I wrote it down, to what extent does... So the public clearly have affection for the monarch, but to what extent does that mean that they would accept monarchic rule? And do the public's opinions matter anyway in all of this?
Well, there's one aspect where I say a monarch has achieved Caesarism, and that was a man who wasn't a king. That was, of course, Oliver Cromwell. but coming to your point, there are a lot of sort of interesting things you bring up. And in terms of understanding like an idealized conception of monarchy, I fundamentally believe, regardless of sort of imperial affectations or the Commonwealth or whatever, which I'll get into in more detail, a king is the patriarch of a tribe, a clan, and thereby, by extension, he is supposed to represent an ethnos, a people. You know, in terms of using this Greek etymology, he is an ethnarch. He is a popular head, head of a populace, head of a nation. Yes, and what I find... And what I find so problematic about Charles is, as I'll explain, he is, in my view, antithetical to that. So going back to what a proper monarch is supposed to do, I do not necessarily believe that a monarch needs to be involved in the day-to-day administration. I believe the monarch should have oversight. I believe the monarch should be there ensuring that his ministers do not sort of deviate and err towards treason. And that, again, would be the obligations of an ethnarch, a true patriarch, someone who's supposed to look after the welfare of his people. There's actually a quote by the Austrian Emperor Franz Joseph, where I think sums up this position best, which is, "My role is to save my people from their governments." And I think what I found so sort of alarming about Charles, in terms of referencing a lot of other sort of bizarre and absurd contradictions here. Obviously, last year, Boris Johnson was forced out of power. Liz Truss was elected, then immediately sort of deposed off the back of a Bank of England instigated coup. And then we all of a sudden have Rishi Sunak, who hasn't won an election and hasn't even won a popular vote by the members of the Conservative Party. So it occurred to me that the first Indian prime minister's only mandate actually comes from the grandson of the last emperor of India, offering that position as, you know, basically India's first viceroy over Great Britain, a complete inversion of history there. And
my God. That is a hell of an observation.
And you can say again, that's the opposite of what a monarch, in my view, is supposed to do
And also, you know, Charles, as you say, an ethnarch, but he's an ethnarch. The public are no longer one single ethnic group, or even a small number of them. We celebrate that they are so multitudinous, and he himself celebrates that. So how can he? So that undermines his own role as an ethnarch. I mean, yes. Again, how perverse could it be?
Yes, exactly. And this is why I'm even loathed to use the terminology such as King of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and why I was prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt for people listening. But I had all of these deep-seated reservations. And of course, I mentioned the idea of Mogulism, which seemed to, even if he was going to be quote-unquote reactionary, it was always going to be in the vein of something that was rather in opposition to this whole idea of the ethnarch. I looked to things such as his paternalistic attitude towards the Duchy of Cornwall, for example, and various aspects of his architectural program, and saying, well, maybe he can take aspects of the globalist agenda and tweak it somewhat to give it more of a conservative edge. Well, unfortunately, that hasn't happened at all. So in terms of being able to understand Charles within the context of, you can say, the ethnic disintegration of a cohesive entity known as England or an entity known as Scotland, or by extension creating the state which is Great Britain, I no longer view him as king, rather I view him as the head of the Commonwealth. And you can see this as espoused in a lot of speeches, especially the speeches he's been making at COP28, the environmental conference or whatever such nonsense, which has been going on in, what is it, Doha at the moment. The reason I think that head of the Commonwealth is apt is that since the end of the British Empire, the British monarchy has been in this very awkward situation, in addition to being powerless in terms of being able to affect the role of an executive in a true monarchical sense. The monarch is not simply the monarch of Great Britain. The monarch has all of the other sort of white dominions, you know, and non-white dominions like Jamaica and the other members that comprise the 56 nations of the Commonwealth. And bizarrely to me, even nations that only had a sliver of territory in the Commonwealth, such as Cameroon, by that logic, China can also be a member of the Commonwealth. So in other words, you have many people who in some cases were never under the rule of the British Empire, or many that were under the rule of the British Empire over 60 years ago in the case of Africa, who are still united to a figure who ultimately should owe these people nothing. And yet when you look at the mission of the Commonwealth, and I was looking over the Commonwealth Charter before coming on. The Commonwealth Charter reads like every pro-globalist diversity, equity, and inclusion, NGO, government, woke sort of capitalist organization, internationalist government institution. So, for example, of its 16 points, point four is called tolerance, respect, and understanding, which basically is a it's basically a euphemism for diversity as our strength. And then we have points 10, 14th, and 15th, which is essentially all about fighting climate change and investing in less developed countries. What that basically means is wealth redistribution from places like Australia, the United Kingdom, and Canada, and giving it to places like Zambia or Nigeria or what have you.
Well, have you any idea when this was implemented, when this was written? Because these are very contemporary concerns. I mean, I wouldn't expect them to be on the agenda 60 years ago.
You're completely right. And this agenda was relatively recent. This was a agreement that was signed 10 years ago. But this was still based on many aspects of what the Commonwealth had represented even before then, not the explicit references to combating climate change and basically a mantra towards diversity, equity, and inclusion, but general sort of notions around upholding human rights. Which
and
is
equality
very...
as well. Basically guilt about the fact that we had, you know, dominated these peoples. It's perhaps worth saying what the British Commonwealth actually was and is, because I think a lot of people see it's funny because it's become one of these globalist institutions, as you say, and like a lot of such institutions, it's sort of invisible. People don't really know even that it still exists. Actually, when I was a child, you heard that word far more frequently than you do now. The Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth, it was a thing. You heard it. You hardly ever hear it nowadays, but it does still exist. So would you like to explain what the Commonwealth, you know, what it is and how it came about?
Well, the most depressing thing about that observation is that it's probably more influential and insidious than it ever has been. But going
that links with the previous stream where we're talking about this. Sorry, go on.
No, but going back to your point, I mean, the Commonwealth is supposed to be a somewhat sort of conservative appellation. It refers back to the common weal, which is the common interest of the subjects of the realm in harmony, in concert with their monarch, representing the common weal, basically the nation as encapsulated. But then you take this idea of the Commonwealth and you broaden it to basically have no national meaning whatsoever. We take the Commonwealth of England and we make it the Commonwealth of the world, the legacy of the British Empire, albeit the Commonwealth and the British Empire were never synonymous. So the Commonwealth originally meant the white settler dominions, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, even South Africa. In other words, it had a specific ethnic white connotation, and it was based around the replication of the Westminster system and some sense of growing parity between the Dominion prime ministers to that of who was at the time, I think it was Stanley Baldwin was the prime minister when all of this was coming about in the 20s and 1930s. So it had a very specific connotation then. But after the independence of India in 1947, the Commonwealth came as an institution, and the India was basically represented within the Commonwealth as some sort of continuity between the end of empire and the beginning of something else. But what this really meant is that between 1948 and the 1960s, 800 million people were now Commonwealth citizens. And in theory, they could actually go and live anywhere in the empire. And of course, this is sort of the beginning of the immigration debate. Until the rules were finally tightened up in the 1960s to prevent anyone from the Commonwealth coming and living in England. But of course, you can probably see that this is the beginning of it.
Yes, and it was too late by then anyway, clearly.
So the
It started.
So the ironic thing is that the institution of the Commonwealth was conceived of only 20 years prior as something being very specific in terms of which nations belonged to it and what ethnicities were going to be represented. And then 20 years later, you have the beginning of essentially what we see now. As all of these countries have basically become independent and they've gravitated towards America, you can basically saying they represent the Anglophone sort of vassals under the system of the Five Eyes, far more so than representing any sort of fealty back to the king and back to queen and, you know, queen, king and country and fidelity to the motherland and all that sort of thing. No, all of that's gone. But the Commonwealth endures as an institution. And what you can see is in terms of the Commonwealth now is that because sub-Saharan Africa is so prominent in that institution, because India, not just India, but India, Bangladesh and Pakistan, all of which were British colonies at some point, are also represented in that institution, that the new mantra of the Commonwealth is about ethnic equality, diversity, and therefore, by extension, there's nothing within the new conception of the Commonwealth that really contradicts this idea of modern multiculturalism. It is multiculturalism on a global scale, and it is also multiculturalism on a local scale with regards to Great Britain itself. But the idea of sustainable development and combating climate change is, of course, part of its modern core creed. And this means wealth redistribution effectively from the quote-unquote more developed nations to the less developed nations, which also includes India. So on the one hand, you have people like Rishi Sunak and David Cameron rushing off to plead to India like supplicants. Yet on the other hand, I believe still the Department of International Development is still giving them money. So all of these sort of ridiculous contradictions we see as Britain loses its role within the Commonwealth, and we are now a relatively small feature, that being Great Britain, within the whole context of this. But the monarchy is not. The monarchy has not diminished. And this is why I find the modern monarchy under Charles is so insidious and why I talk about this idea of neo-mogulism. In many ways, I find it so horrific that we have the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, celebrating the Hindu ceremony of lights, Diwali. These two figures, the head of the Church of England and the supreme prelate, chief cleric of the Church of England, are both there espousing the values of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I didn't definitively make up my mind on Charles until a couple of weeks ago, when I saw him at COP28. The first thing I saw in terms of compounding the preposterousness when I mentioned to you earlier about him being constitutionally responsible for appointing Rishi Sunak, a foreigner, to govern over essentially Great Britain, despite the fact he's supposed to represent an ethnarch. Well, there's been a flare-up about the Elgin Marbles controversy recently. It flummoxed a diplomatic meeting between, I think, the Greek Prime Minister and Rishi Sunak. And Rishi Sunak, I think, the first time I've seen in the year that he's been Prime Minister, actually grew a backbone and said, we won't just give you the Elgin Marbles. What I find remarkable about this is that Charles, counter-signaling this, goes to COP28 wearing a Greek flag tie.
What the hell? Sorry, go on.
Well, no, just think about, again, the absurdity that we have the Indian Prime Minister of Britain standing up for Britain's possession of the Elgin Marbles versus the British King who is standing here for the Greeks. It's just...
It's farcical. You couldn't make it up. And it's like something from a comedy where the person is doing exactly the opposite of what they're supposed to be doing. Like, his role is not to stand up for diversity or the Greeks. It's to stand up for his people, who are the British. I mean, it's incredible what's happened here. But there has been this disconnection has occurred between, well, the rulers and the ruled. I mean, it's everywhere. And I think it's sad in the case of a monarchy, because there's this romance about the monarchy, which isn't there with politicians. I mean, everyone assumes that politicians are, you know, in it for themselves, an eye for the main chance, men in the make, grubby, corrupt, and all that. But we still have this romantic idea that the monarch is not like that. And it's the institution and the person is going to be an exemplary person, someone who is fully immersed in their nation's culture and history and cognizant of their unique duty and role in that society. And yet Charles III just seems to be completely out to lunch on everything, every aspect of this.
I think the saddest thing about that is that I believe, in a way, he does believe he's possessed of the history. He's possessed of the magnitude, which is the institution. But instead, he has drawn from it all the wrong conclusions.
Well, look, just to intervene briefly, there's a thing in Germany where German politicians will say that someone is a good German if he is pro-diversity. If he's anti-German, then that makes him a good German. I think in a similar way, I can imagine Charles saying, well, I am embodying Britain's outwardness and its openness by destroying Britain.
In essence, you're completely correct. I mean, it seems benign when you have the Protestant coronation ceremony attended by Catholics, attended by Orthodox, attended by other non-Episcopalian Protestants, attended by Buddhists, attended by Jews. But then you understand the implication that this is simply a haute iteration of diversity, equity, and inclusion, one that necessarily isn't quite as offensive, but the implications, you know, this isn't like race swapping Isaac Newton. This is done with a bit more subtlety, where you can perhaps be sort of still enamored of the pomp and ceremony and the fabulous costumes and the ancient roles of the ceremony regarding the props, the figures, the pageantry. But in the end, it ultimately serves the same purpose. I mean, going back to the idea of Charles and the whole deracinated idea of him almost representing a out-group preference, again, going back to the Greeks, I'll use a term coined by Roger Scruton, the idea of oikophobia, referencing back to the idea of Greeks. Of course, oikos means home. Mm-hmm. So oikophobia means a fear of home, literally. But you can say in Charles, that's even more complicated, because what's his home? I mean, just looking at Greece, for example, his father was, of course, Prince Philip. Before 1947, he was Prince Philip of Greece. He was a member of the Greek Orthodox Church. Charles, I believe, went on a pilgrimage to Mount Athos, which is the sort of great monastery compound. I hate to use that word, but it's a sacred site for members of the Greek Orthodox denomination. And indeed, it's a general Christian pilgrimage site for all denominations. But it makes you wonder, you know, if he is a Christian, what sort of Christian is he? You know, I've heard people basically saying, oh, he converted to Catholicism. Oh, he converted to Greek Orthodoxy. Oh, he converted to Sufi Islam based on his reference to René Guénon. So you can say that he is desperately trying to emulate the perfect, sort of represent the perfect encapsulation of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But like I said, he's trying to elevate a concept which is antithetical to the notion that he is representative of a nation that he is representative of an ethnarch. And my solution to this is that I will have a king of England, or I will have nothing. I will not have a head of the Commonwealth, and I don't believe that the institution deserves to be saddled with all the pomp and ceremony, the ancient vestige and the history, when it is antithetical to the role that it's supposed to be serving, which is ultimately the protection of home. And you can say the most basic point, of course, is being able to recognize treason. And I think you and I will both be in agreement that treason is endemic everywhere in the West. It's a feature of our political system.
Yes. Well, I think that, see, this links to what you were just saying about his father. I think that the higher echelons of our society used to be, I think they were always probably more cosmopolitan than everyday folk, than ordinary people. But nowadays, and for the last 100 years, really, they've tended to be much more than in the past cosmopolitan. They've gone to international schools. They've traveled around an awful lot more and more as time has passed. And so I think for a time, this was feasible. They could be cosmopolitan and yet, and have an affinity with each other, regardless of what country they came from, because they would have interests in common, hobbies in common. But there was still an understanding that, yes, even though you and I can discuss Brahms together, you are for the German people and I am for the English people. We possibly identify with each other more than we do with our respective peoples, and yet our duty is to our respective peoples. I think that was an understanding at the elite level for a long time, but eventually, perhaps inevitably, it was going to buckle. Because they would realize, well, we really do identify more with each other than with our peoples. And our bloodlines are mixed at this level anyway. My father's Greek, my mother's German and English, et cetera, et cetera. So, in other words, it becomes sort of inevitable that they will adopt this globalist mindset at their level, which then, of course, fully severs them, well, not fully, but let's say profoundly severs them from their ethnic group, from their nation. And then, of course, they want their globalism, they want to impose that on their countries, which otherwise would be embarrassing relics to them. Do you see what I mean?
I think I would actually say that one of the remarkable things about monarchy as an institution is that in spite of what you said, which is completely true regarding the intermingling, that nationalism was able to survive within the context of monarchy. So just to put this in perspective, you can point to a monarch like Charles V, who was Holy Roman Emperor, and he was also King of Spain. He was the King of the Netherlands, modern-day Belgium, owned large parts of Italy. At one point, he actually controlled Austria. But he adopted a practice of to be ruler of all is to be ruler of each. Which meant that in spite of the fact that he could not obviously represent an ethnarch, he would rule each of these territories according to the customs, their ancient customs, and invariably appoint councils filled with local rulers. So, for example, in France, you're going to appoint someone from Burgundy. In Aragon, which is modern-day sort of Catalonia and eastern Spain, you appoint someone who is a Catalan. You appoint a Castilian in, you know, the core of Spain, an Italian in Naples, etc., etc. You still had a king, an overarching figure, but in complete contrast to what we have with Charles as head of the Commonwealth, there we have a monarch who is able to represent all. It is able to maintain a faithful sort of adherence to the customs of each. It is diversity. But it is, you can say, the best encapsulation of each nation kept apart, as opposed to all intermingling in a ultimately indistinguishable mire in terms of diversity, ultimately being monotony, homogeneity.
Well, indeed, and that's the whole contradiction at the heart of diversity, is that ultimately the only way to have a diverse population and a diverse culture is to treat it in such ways that it will inevitably become homogenous. The peoples will mix, the cultures will blend together in the end. Because otherwise, what you're going to have, the only thing you can promise the people is endless conflict, a future of conflict. So it has to go in that direction. And I think that's the way that they've reconciled this kind of dual loyalty, triple loyalty. The way the elites have reconciled it now is to simply nullify these differences, to nullify the borders, or at least to make them as good as nullified. So you have a globalist prime minister, globalist chancellor, globalist opposition leader, etc., in every country, who ostensibly is serving that country, but really not at all. And you can see this, with that one exception with Rishi Sunak aside, which was possibly for PR purposes, who knows? But that exception aside, you know, Jacinda Ardern, does she actually give a toss about the New Zealand? Mark Rutte, who we were talking about earlier, does he give a toss about the Dutch? Justin Trudeau, there are several apocryphal quotes from him about the Canadian people, but there are real ones as well, where he voices contempt for the idea of heritage Canadians. I mean, this I think is the only way that you can really, an elite can handle being so divided. In this age, there are other ways that they could have handled it. They could have said, okay, I'm half Dutch, I'm a quarter Italian, I'm a quarter French. Well, I'm just going to have to choose one. But instead they say, no, the way I'll reconcile this is to just nullify these differences and blend everyone together.
I think there are quite a few points you've raised there, which I'd like to bring up. One, again, is actually putting back to this idea of monarchy at the beginning of the 20th century and monarchy now, which are, you can't even recognize them. Because, again, despite the fact that you're right, they represented an elite, and this is an elite that was always understood right from the beginning of, you can say, the institution of monarchy, and monarchy is conceived of in the Middle Ages itself, that it was an elite club. They represent princes. They had a concept of vice regency, i.e. their authority was bestowed as a trust by God. And because of that, they could not be treated as other people. This was famously the defense of Mary, Queen of Scots, after the Babington plot, but ultimately it was to no avail because she became executed. So yes, there's an understanding there. And before the emergence of nationalism, the idea between monarch is an ethnarch and monarch is simply possessing a territory, sometimes over many ethnicities, was blurred. But by the 19th century and the 20th century, you had this remarkable situation where nearly all of the high-ranking monarchs of Europe, from the Danes to the Russians to the Germans to the British, were in some way related to Queen Victoria. In the same way that in the 1860s, you had this mass proliferation of the Danish royal family, which married into the Russians and became the progenitors of the Greek royal family, which is why Prince Philip is a blood relative to Nicholas II, and why they used his DNA when they exhumed the bodies recently. But regardless of that, Tsar Nicholas II had a conception of Russia which was ancient and truly mystical. In many ways, you can say far more so than any other ruler, despite the fact that ethnically he was essentially German and Dutch through all of his ancestors. So even though he wasn't of the ethnicity, he was still able to represent a ancient sense of ethnos in the case of Russia. Same with Kaiser Wilhelm II. Kaiser Wilhelm II was, of course, the eldest grandchild of Queen Victoria. And yet you can never say he was anything other than ardent German nationalist. So in many ways, you can say that despite representing a recognizable elite strata, the defense of monarchy, it also represented a European civilization, but it also represented the particularism within Europe. Yes, we can all be European. We can all support the institution of monarchy, but I am Russian, I am German, I am Austrian, I am Italian, and we will not all be the same. What is so horrific about the institution we've had post-World War II since 1945 is that monarchy has simply become an ornamentation, and it is a permitted ornamentation. Whenever monarchy veers off, it ends badly. So in the case of this country, 1936, when we had the brief reign of Edward VIII was veering off script. So there was a conspiracy between the Conservative Party and the Church of England to depose him using Wallace Simpson as a pretext. There's another example, which is actually barely ever mentioned, but I'll mention it anyway, which is the case of Leopold III in Belgium. Of course, Belgium has a royal family. interestingly, considering the relatively sort of recent sort of liberal history of Belgium. But anyway, during World War II, Belgium is invaded. The Belgian king has a very distinct conception of what it is to be the chief of the Belgian army. And so he will not retreat. He will not go over to Britain and establish a government in exile. He will instead surrender with his men. You can say almost as an ancient king surrendering his sword to the conqueror. But because of that, he was derided for the rest of his reign as a Nazi collaborator. He caused a constitutional crisis within Belgium. And a year after he was allowed to come back, when basically the Americans rescinded a ban from him coming back to his own kingdom of Belgium, he was deposed and had to force his son essentially to become king. When you look at European monarchies beyond that, and then of course we have the Italian monarchy voting itself out of existence in 1946, the monarchies that we have left beyond the British monarchy are essentially monarchies which officiate over constitutional, almost sort of republican, formally republican constitutions, like the Netherlands, like Belgium, like Sweden, like Denmark, like Norway, even Spain. The only thing you can say that Spain has going for it as a monarchy is that Spain's monarchy was instituted by Franco. But of course, who is the one who ultimately betrays the Francoist settlement? It is a king of Spain. It's Juan Carlos. The only thing you can say that Philippe has, the current king of Spain, has going for him is that the constitution of Spain is predicated around holding the Spanish nation together, preventing Basque and Catalan nationalism. But there's just been a situation in Spain where a leftist government has been re-elected and they formed pacts with Catalan nationalists. This has caused major sort of upheaval in Spain and a large amount of sort of right-wing, invariably Catholic protests there. But I don't think the king is actually going to stake his political reputation and stand up for the ancient conception of Spain as representing some sort of supreme reality, integrating all of these territories together. It'll be interesting to see, in which case you can say the Spanish monarchy can truly encapsulate the idea of an ethnarch, but I won't hold my breath. Even when you look at monarchies that have been dispossessed, like the Habsburgs, or like the Orleanists, or even the Bonapartes, you know, what is the current sort of Napoleon done today? Oh, he became a banker. When you look at the Habsburgs, say, for example, you look at Karl von Habsburg, and you look at his father, Otto, both became European Christian Democrats. They both became members of the European Parliament. And what I find quite horrific about Karl von Habsburg, and not only did he go into the whole, you know, COVID-19 nonsense and the vaccination mania, but the whole reason why his specific branch of the dynasty came to power was because Franz Ferdinand, the man who was assassinated, and I'm not going to get into the causes of World War I, but most people have heard of Franz Ferdinand.
Yes.
He was not allowed to pass on the succession to his children because of something called a morganatic marriage, wherein he married an unequal. He married a countess, and thereby his children could not inherit because they were not of the blood royal. George, who is the brother of Karl von Habsburg, married a blood royal, so he's fine. But Karl, the current leader, did not marry of the blood royal, and he in fact divorced. And this is, of course, him being ostensibly a Catholic. So we have a Christian Democrat and a divorcee. So what I'm saying is that even the non-reigning monarchies, you can say, who have license to remain more pure to the principles of an abstract while not actually being in power, are deviating from this. And Charles is probably the most horrific instance. I mean, I couldn't have been the only one to notice during the coronation that you had Charles's queen's ex-husband and her family sitting opposite the royal family. I mean, Cosmo Lang would have been turning in his grave to see that the legacy of the abdication settlement was this.
Yeah, it is a very, and the, yeah, you see, it is a very new thing. It's a new phase in the history of the British monarchy that we're seeing here. And of course, what promises to follow this is the era of William and Kate. I think they're still the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. I can never, well, she's the Duchess of Cambridge, well, whatever. So that's going to be a new thing as well. And they are also pro-diversity and all the rest of it. I think part of a problem here, aside from all the other things that you've talked about, there's also the simple problem that you can't get people to continue believing in this, in the necessity for certain requirements, when they're not religious, when the public aren't as pious as they once were, and also when you're separate thing, when you're specifically telling them how evil it is to care about things like, you know, racial purity and bloodlines and stuff. Well, how can you then tell them it's a problem that he's married a countess? That's going to really mess things up for his kids, because they're obviously not going to be as high quality people as they would have been if their mother was off his own level. I mean, that's really unfashionable, to say the least. That is unfashionable talk for this era. You see what I mean?
No, it is, but all this, again, is indicative of the word I used at the beginning, despoiliation.
Yes.
Back in the early 20th century, we have figures like Mary of Teck. Then George VI marries the Queen Mother, who, of course, was, I believe, a countess. Queen Elizabeth II actually made the strange decision of marrying someone of the blood royal. But she didn't do so because of expectation. She did so contrary to expectations, because he was tainted with a whiff of Greek republicanism and all that sort of thing, and the very tentative position of the Greek royal family, who were ultimately removed several times. But of course, with Charles, one of the rubrics of the post-1688 monarchy was the act of succession, which not only forbade Catholics from becoming kings, but prevented Catholics from marrying kings as well. And when we look at someone like Camilla Parker Bowles, I believe she was raised a Catholic, and she is also divorced. So in both senses, she represents some sort of a religious and dynastic contradiction there.
Some people might say, well, it doesn't matter. Who really cares whether she's a Protestant or a Catholic in this day and age, when half of us are atheists anyway? But the thing is, that decline enables the subsequent decline, whereby Harry marries someone who's not even white.
Yes, exactly.
Not even British, not even English.
Well, you can say with, you know, William. You know, William marries Kate, who isn't even noble. And then the next progression from that is, as you say, Harry marrying Meghan Markle, which is, in terms of, you know, an appropriate consort. All I'm trying to say is that once all of these things, no matter, become a topic of consideration, you don't need to buy into the institution of the monarchy anymore. Just get rid of it. If you're not going to hold the monarchy to any sort of religious conception, which is why it's there, if you're not going to hold it to a ethnic consideration, i.e. it doesn't have to be a king under Christ, it can just be a king, it can just be, you know, a Germanic chieftain, it can just be an Anglo-Saxon chieftain, for goodness sake, and still hold the title of king. It doesn't have to have any Christian connotations, but even that is beyond the possibility of the current realms of politics. And then you have the idea of, you know, the king ruling over his own territory. Well, again, that's clearly a farce as well. So if the monarchy isn't even able to uphold these very sort of particular social qualifications as well, then all of this does is show that what we are represented with is purely an idolatrous, it's basically an idol. It's essentially a golden bull which is now being placed on top of the mantra, which is currently our sort of globalist political system. And unfortunately, when I see it, again, saying this completely without sentiment, I see it as, I feel iconoclastic. I look at this and seeing that we are worshipping the image. We are worshipping the bull. We are not even understanding. It is beyond our comprehension to signify what is the stuff, what is the material which made this image, what is this image supposed to signify, what it has become. No, all of these things are beyond those sort of considerations. And instead, we are stuck purely with the image and worship of the image, which is why I push back against sentimentality and against the idea of this kitsch. And I also want to use this opportunity to compare Queen Elizabeth II with Charles, and why I'm probably far more vitriolic about Charles than I am about Queen Elizabeth II, because Queen Elizabeth II was very subtle in terms of the permissible elements which caused, again, further the despoliation of the monarchy, in terms of her allowing things such as the massive constitutional settlement of Tony Blair, you know, the creation of the Supreme Court, the beginning of mass migration, the gutting of the House of Lords, all of these things which seriously damaged the institution of the monarchy. Then I personally looked to instances like when John Bercow was basically running the country during Brexit and say that this is fundamentally a inability of a monarch to represent any sort of political good. The fact that her position is so vacuous that a nobody, which is the Speaker of the House of Commons, is basically running the country because there is no presidential head, there is no head of state who can actually affect policy. But for all, you know, her warts, yes, she did occasionally say things like diversity is our strength in a Christmas message. But she attempted, at least, not successfully, but attempted to represent an aspect of political moderation. Where it comes to Charles, Charles does not represent that. And it goes back to that point you were raising earlier, which is this idea of the current elites representing a club which is completely removed from anyone that they are supposed to represent, either a Mark Rutte, either a Rishi Sunak, or either a King of England. And I mentioned other examples of royalty, and I'm going to emphasize this again. King Charles matters more than the King of the Netherlands. He matters more than the King of Sweden due to his presence, his prestige, and the many monarchies of which he's supposed to represent, the fact that he is king of so many domains and he is head of the Commonwealth. When he says something, it matters more than almost any other monarchy. The only exceptions I'll probably put to that are Middle Eastern monarchs, who are actually monarchs in the real sense and are actually able to dictate policies during their own populations, as was actually proven at COP28. But the summit of all this, the outgroup preference, the deracination, the elite club of all of these people only talking to each other, and this idea essentially of them being deluded enough to believe that when they are spouting a political mantra, Charles probably thinks it is so agreed upon that it transcends the realms of policy. It transcends the levels of public debate to the point that it has simply become non-negotiable. You know, Tony Blair was brilliant at being able to exemplify these things, that when he emphasized a policy, it was about transcending factionalism. It simply became the state of how things were. It was progress, and anything against that was simply beyond the pale.
Well, he would literally talk about things as if they had already happened. So there really wasn't any debate to be had. This is just an inevitability that the job is to make people accept it.
Yes. And this all, to me, is encapsulated in what Charles has been doing over the last few weeks at COP28. I mentioned the coronation Commonwealth Charter. I mentioned points 10, 14, and 15, which are about renewable energy, sustainable development, combating climate change in less developing countries, emphasis on economic development of those territories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, you can say it represents a form of climate covenant. Charles, when he was speaking recently, emphasized the role that we should be doing more to intervene to cope with the climate catastrophe. He referenced his position as the head of the Commonwealth explicitly to say that it is these less developed countries who are going to be the ones who are going to be victims of climate change, et cetera, et cetera. So unlike Queen Elizabeth, who will give a subtle nod whereby she may intimate to a minister to say, do something about climate change, what we have with King Charles is the most extreme espousal of the climate alarmist agenda, the most extreme iteration of the principles that have basically been decided by the Commonwealth Charter, which is global action, money, resources, policy, international cooperation, collective action, all of these things that any other politician in his ilk would be describing, but it's instead been delivered by the King of the Great Britain, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. He has gone beyond the role of royal impartiality, and he has essentially encapsulated the spirit of Tony Blair. This is a principle that defines the Commonwealth. It is a principle that goes beyond politics. It is as sacred as democracy, as equality and inclusion. And it is something that virtually all of our elites are in total lockstep agreement with. you know, I was prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that, you know, he had failed categorically from the beginning to recognize the friend-enemy distinction, which would mean that his environmentalism ultimately became sullied by association with globalists. But I don't believe that's true anymore. I believe that this is his explicit want to supplement what you can say is a conservative conception of conservation, which is basically not wanting everything to be turned into massive cities, suburban complexes, slums, refugee camps, wanting to be at harmony with nature, you know, even supporting things like forestation and depopulation and things like that, versus global mechanisms of economic and political intervention to control something which is essentially becoming more of a modern eschatology. It is the end of the world. It is millenarianism. It is, we have killed God, and we are placing climate change as the new vehicle of the apocalypse. You say on the one hand that the religion has become, you know, absurd to many people who have become agnostic or openly atheistic. Charles has supplemented all of these religious aspects, you know, dispensing with the formal sort of defense of the Reformed confession in England, and he has sublimated it to the Supreme Confession, which is that of climate alarmism. And that is why I am adopting such a hardline position today, probably more hardline than I would have a couple of months ago, had this occurred a couple of months ago. But I looked at all of this and I thought that this is the culmination of all of my worst fears regarding Charles. And it matters because Charles is, you know, people are saying he's the World Economic Forum king. No, Charles has his own platform. Charles has his own prestige independent of Klaus Schwab. He doesn't need Klaus Schwab. When he speaks, he doesn't have to be a member of the global youth leaders or whatever they're called. You know, ultimately, you can say the World Economic Forum is a networking organization, all espousing some sort of similar values, but it's also a way to get in power. Charles doesn't need that. He's already in power. He already monopolizes his position, and he uses it to augment the policies of people who are completely opposed to the continued existence of an England or a Scotland as it could possibly exist and has existed historically. Anyway, that's my rant over, but hopefully everyone can understand my point.
Yes, and fascinatingly espoused. Well, I do think that climate change is being, implemented as a sort of religion. The first time I read this concept must have been 2008, 2007. I remember there was a website called numberwatch.org, if I recall correctly. And he wrote this essay, I think it was called Climate Change as a Religion. And he talked about these different aspects, like it has the rituals, the ceremonies, the sins, the salvation, and the high priests, and so on. And it's actually quite strange, because you wouldn't need so many analogues in it. But there are, they are there. And the whole thing, the faith, that as well, it does take on the social and psychological role of a religion. And I think that it keeps coming back. There was a big craze about climate change in the mid-2000s, which I don't think a lot of people have probably forgotten about now. It got swept aside when the global financial crisis started. But then it gradually came back throughout the 2010s, culminating with the era of Greta Thunberg. Then COVID happened and really took center stage. That's over now, and climate change is starting again. But Ukraine and then Gaza have obviously taken center stage. But I think that climate change will, they're still talking about it. And it was hardly muted during COVID, to be honest. Unlike in 2008, when it just disappeared from public life. In 2020, it didn't. It remained. It wasn't the number one thing, but it was certainly still talked about. They kept citing it. They kept, keeping it in the public's consciousness. And so we're now in 2023, nearly 24, and there's all the talk about Agenda 2030, which is very much centered around climate change and the need to respond to it. And I think that throughout this decade, they're going to try to really hammer it home, make people obsessed with it. and implement it as a sort of religion, where the salvation comes from being as carbon neutral as you possibly can, as a life form, as a biological entity. You've got to try to leave as little of a footprint as you possibly can on the world, which is an interesting stipulation to make of people, because it's actually a very onerous thing to do. You're making 100 different demands of them when you set that up as their life goal. And so it enables all sorts of state intervention and state surveillance on people's lives. So I do agree with you. And I think that, I mean, one way of looking at Charles's involvement with this is to say that, well, he's actually doing what, in some sense, he's doing what a monarch is supposed to do. He's leading. And as you say, he doesn't need the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, whatever. He doesn't need any of them. He is powerful in and of himself. So he's leading. What would you say to that?
Well, this is a point that I actually wanted to bring up, which is, again, a terrifying realization, which I came to over the last few weeks, is that he probably has more power than Rishi Sunak. He probably has more power than anyone in Parliament at the moment, especially when you consider that all the quote-unquote Conservative Party are trying to do is, I don't know, I don't think they're not even trying to do damage control before they lose the next election. They seem to be content to do nothing and let the civil service run the country or not run the country or whatever you're going to look at. So in that sense, you can say that Prince Charles has far more power than any elected official, and you can say that this represents a return to monarchical power. But unlike Charles I, he is not monarch of Great Britain. He is monarch of something else. He is the head of his own globalist organization. He is the monarch of that. And in that sense, he has more influence than, you can almost say it's like Sadiq Khan, as preposterous as this is. Sadiq Khan, as mayor of London, again, I believe, probably has more power than Rishi Sunak. Because London, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of global politics, matters more than the rest of England. It just does. Not just in terms of London basically as a forerunner for the, accelerated process of diversity, equity, and inclusion, but in terms of being a economic and financial hub, which of course it's been for hundreds of years. In that sense, Sadiq Khan talks to other mayors about all of these progressive values and curbing aspects of, say, for example, Geert Wilders and the rise of the quote-unquote far right, as you and I may dispute those terms, I believe he has genuine influence, in the same way that when King Charles goes on and talks about increased climate action, him saying it, especially in terms of the Anglophone world, not just the Dominions, but also America, I think it means a lot more than even when someone like Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, echoes almost the exact same sentiments. On the one hand, you should find that horrifying, the fact the King of England is sounding like the president of the European Commission, especially given Brexit, which I think you and I both agree has amounted to nothing.
Yes.
But that is the King of England saying it, the King of Great Britain. And this is the culmination of the points I've been trying to raise here, is that he is not an ethnarch. He is not a religious head. He is not a king in the traditional sense. He is the head of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is something different. And you mentioned the continuity of the climate narrative. Well, this is key because many of the proposals or the possibilities opened up during COVID are feeding into the whole narrative of climate control. So we talk about lockdowns. Oh, that reduces emissions. We talk about preventing people traveling. Now we have the whole idea of an annual carbon allowance. We talk about the idea of 15-minute cities where everything can be attained locally. But again, we're basically seeing this as the potentiality for climate lockdowns. All of these insidious policies. But when it comes to Charles, and when it comes to his economic policy, his espousal of the Commonwealth Charter, him pioneering that, him championing that policy, it also adopts a anti-racist perspective, as again, when you think about the implications here, because climate action means resolving inequality. It means about looking outwards towards less developed countries It means looking towards sub-Saharan Africa. It means looking towards India. It's the anticipation that climate change is going to cause mass economic devastation and, by extension, mass human flight, which is going to lead to more immigration, which is going to end up on our doorstep. So in many ways, you can say Charles is embodying all of these talking points. And what is the consistent theme with all of these talking points? Completely antithetical to the interests of Great Britain.
Yes, or even to the existence of the British people.
Or that's European civilization.
Yes, indeed. All of these precious things. Okay, well, I think we should probably end it there. This has been a fantastic talk, so thank you very much for agreeing to do it. Let me just see if there are any super chats. I know that there was one posted earlier. Right. Okay. What are your views on the Jacobite claim to the British throne, the current claimant being Franz, Duke of Bavaria? And is it time to withdraw the Windsors?
This is an interesting question, and it's one that I have a rather nuanced take on. Obviously, I have Jacobite sympathies because the Jacobites represented represented the continuity of Charles and Charles II and James II. They represented the alternative form of monarchy, where monarchy actually meant something before the Dutch coup in 1688. It represents a revolt against this idea of the Whig republicanism, which evolves into what we have now. However, my view on it is slightly contested. Despite coming up and actually saying this as a Catholic, I believe that James II's sympathy towards Catholicism in many ways doomed him. I believe pragmatically it would have been much better to pursue a policy of Catholicizing the Church of England rather than separating the Church of England from Catholicism by offering Catholics privileges within it. If anything, if he made the Church of England more Catholic, it would have begun to look like High Anglicanism, like that of Cardinal Newman in the 19th century, the Oxford School trying to rejuvenate Anglicanism before becoming ultimately Catholics. It'll be interesting to see if James II took that route, but he took the route which alienated everyone and created the royal schism, which is that of the original 1688, but then the Hanoverians and the Jacobites, the Hanoverians who had a very weak claim, but had the benefit, of course, for living under a republican form of government, which favoured them over a restoration of Catholic royalism, which were represented by the Jacobites. But obviously that's a romantic appeal, it's a romantic affectation. And ever since the demise of the last Jacobite claimant, real one, which was Cardinal Henry IX in the beginning of the 19th century, none of these claimants, whether they be Habsburg, whether they be Savoyard, whether they be Wittelsbach, which is the royal family of Bavaria, or whether they be members of the House of Liechtenstein. I believe the current Prince of Liechtenstein has just died, so the new Prince of Liechtenstein would technically be the Jacobite claimant after the death of Franz. And I believe he might have a younger brother, but I need to look up these things. I haven't looked these up for a long time. Pardon my sins there. But all of this is academic. It's one thing to look to Jacobite sympathy in the 19th century and the 18th century. I mean, you know, even George IV, a Hanoverian king, had a Jacobite sort of nostalgic romanticism about him, but he was permitted that because the Jacobites were no longer a political threat. When looking at someone like the Windsors, I mean, obviously it's advisable that we need someone better than a Charles. We need someone better than the William. William, I mean, the only benefit of him vis-a-vis Charles is that I don't think William would actually be going on and championing these policies. I think he would just be reading from cue cards. Like I said, I don't believe there's any sort of intellectual bedrock when it comes to William. So he may be a more passive iteration of what we see with King Charles. But if there's going to be a new king, it has to be someone who actually puts himself forward to be king and represents these things which I've tried to illustrate Charles does not represent. Yes, it would help, perhaps, if it was a Jacobite claimant, even though I don't believe that's possible. But it could basically be anyone. You may think this woes, it might be quite remarkable to bring up, but looking at Donald Trump, you would see perhaps the antithesis of what you would colloquially sort of conceive of as a monarch. But yet at the same time, for all of his flaws, he did espouse the policy of America First. And that as a mantra is far more sort of indicative of a real monarch than anything that's come out of our sort of royalist institutions over the last 100 years.
Yes, that concern should be first and foremost. What is good for Britain and the British people? I mean, that, I just think that's an essential for any group to survive. And that tends to be the attitude of other ethnic groups in other countries. They think, what is good for us? I mean, right now with this thing with the Israelis and the Palestinians, what is good for the Palestinians? What is good for the Israelis? No one is asking what is good for Western Europe, what is good for Britain. So we will get saddled with potentially 2 million Palestinians because that is what is good for the Israelis and what is good for the Palestinians in the absence of a homeland. But no one is asking what's good for us. Our priorities, our good doesn't come up anywhere. And I think this is a sign of the way things are and a reason for the way things are, both at the same time.
No, I agree with you. And one of the things I've been considering, you know, obviously, if that were to happen in this country, it wouldn't happen as it did historically. This person would adopt the title president. So what would be needed for there to be a true sort of restoration of royalism, you know, a true sort of King of England? I think a necessity would actually be the collapse of the American Empire, because the American Empire perpetuates imitation of its own system, i.e. quote-unquote democracy, quote-unquote rules-based international order, free and fair elections. Even as I say that, you wince at all that because you see what's going on with the Democratic Party in America today. But yes, Nevertheless, that is an imperial creed. And it is also the creed of the Charter of the Commonwealth. So until these things are dispensed with, you may have a situation like we saw in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. Europe in the 1920s and 30s was post-monarchical, yet it was also not controlled by the Americans. You had people who didn't adopt the title of kings, but they were kings in all but name. I'm thinking of figures such as Adolphus in Austria, Horthy in Hungary, Franco in Spain, even figures such as Pilsudski in Poland or Mannerheim in Finland. All of these figures had essentially the qualities of kingship. They simply weren't called kings. And in the absence of the American Empire and the Soviet Empire, the political conditions could facilitate a form of localized Caesarism, like we saw in the 1920s and 30s. Obviously, Mussolini is another case, and you might even say the Mustache Man is another case of this. But it sort of proves my point in a way that it may not be called a king, but it will have to sort of come about in one form or another. And the question is whether it is going to be sort of Caesaristic or whether this... did you actually see there was Tom Holland and Rory Stewart created this, I think it was a BBC hit piece on Julius Caesar.
And yes, I think I heard about this. But it's got merged with the Ridley Scott's attack on Napoleon. So it's got overwritten by that.
Well, the funny thing is about this series, from what I've been told, is that it is basically like optimatis propaganda. It's oh, republicanism was great, you know, that and that. And, you know, Caesar was awful because he appealed to the people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, obviously, they're looking at this and they're ideologically repulsed by the idea of what I'm talking about, which is this idea of a ruler emerging from below and toppling all of these completely removed elites. But you can obviously see it. And because this whole sort of control has to be totalizing, then you have to project it further into history. I mean, obviously, this is what communist regimes did, and this is what Whig historiography did. So it's only natural that when you look at someone like Napoleon, you have to say, oh, he was simply domineering because he was simping for Josephine.
Of course, I forgot that you'd... I watched your review of it. I saw the film as well.
I'm very sorry for you.
Yeah. It's mutual. It was quite an experience, quite an ordeal. But anyway, I'll proceed to the next super chat. Have you read the works of Antony Ludovici, specifically his text In Defense of Aristocracy, written in 1915 after the Parliament Act 1911?
I might have read it a long time ago. I'm aware of Ludovici, but I need to point something out that I forget a lot. You know, people think I have a good memory, but in reality, you know, my brain is just sort of strewn with the ruins of what I've, you know, once remembered and now have forgotten. So possibly I might go out and review that, but off the top of my head, no, I can't remember anything. So sorry.
I know the feeling. All right. Ethelward says, a race or ethnos of a people should always come before the religion and before the term civilization. Any dispute of this does not put the homogenous ethnic group as their top priority. Yes, I think I would agree with that. I think that a belief system or a culture should be ethnically rooted. I would agree with that.
Yes, but I mean, all of these are interconnected as far as I can see. Yes. I mean, obviously, this is an argument for a return to some form of sort of national deism. And, you know, if I'm going to take a completely objective form of that, you know, there is a case for that. You can have paganistic governments that can actually rub along quite well with each other, especially as they're not universalist. You can take a perennialist attitude and say there is an ethnic context in which all of these religions could be equally true. Obviously, I personally disavow that, but regardless, academically, I can say there is a case towards that. But regarding ethnos and civilization, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. I think civilization and culture, and then coming up to civilization, is the best way to solidify, consolidate, and root an ethnicity to create a nation. If you're solely focused on ethnicity, I mean, I did watch a bit of the previous conversation here, but focus on tribalism and ethnicity might look a lot like sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, well, that's a danger, but it's a whole other topic that I don't want to get into at this stage in the stream, because we've only got 7 minutes left. Okay, Angriff says, what role does the right of the conqueror have in monarchy? I think we've already covered that, really, when you were talking about various figures from the... Well, do you have anything to say about it?
Well, I mean, we mentioned it at the beginning, Cromwell. Yeah. Cromwell could have become our version of Napoleon. Napoleon could have become a second Charlemagne. You know, he failed. But it is possible that he could have completely restructured European monarchy around the Bonapartist dynasty and around his Caesarian imperial headship. So obviously, I believe that's a quality, and I believe that's something we have to think about today. Because if we look at things like hereditary monarchy and we look at things like dynasticism, I believe we're well past the point of really caring about those things anymore, unfortunately. If you can point to one monarchical head in the West who can actually represent any of the, even a smidgen of what myself and Woz have been talking about on this stream, then I might be able to concede that. But I think this really is a period of the conquerors, unfortunately, or the would-be conquerors. I have little indication of seeing that at the moment.
Yeah. Trad Dad says, my favourite season. Thank you very much. Sore Arm says, great start to Millennial today. Looking forward to it as usual. Great lineup. Thank you. Soccer City, vintage Dungeons and Dragons books are the new Bitcoin. Okay, I'll take your word for it. Houdini, was all of this decline caused by John Lackland signing a piece of paper?
You're going to have to explain that to me. I don't know
what the reference is, so I'm afraid we'll have to skip that one. Sorry, Houdini. Okay. Oh, if you could, this is Hinchfoot, if you could flick a switch to swap our current democratic system to sovereign rule by our current royal family, would you flick it? I think the obvious answer to that is no, but do you have anything to say?
Sorry. Just going back to the previous super chat, Lackland confused me, but it means John, King John. And obviously the piece of paper he's referring to is Magna Carta.
Oh, okay.
I would never forgive myself if I hadn't pointed out that. But I think that's overplayed. I will die on the hill of saying Magna Carta is only significant in retrospect, and not even really in retrospect. It's basically it's seen as one of these documents that precede the 1688 English Bill of Rights and the American Declaration of Independence. But before then, it's really just part of the mire of English constitutional history and was basically sort of nullified by previous acts. So I don't really put that much stock in it. Talk about democracy or Southern Britain. Was that the gist of the super chat?
Yeah, if you could flick a switch to swap our current democratic system to sovereign rule by our current royal family, would you flick it? I think the obvious answer is no.
What, get rid of democracy and get a sovereign monarchy?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we don't have a democracy.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Democracy is a misnomer, and it's always been a misnomer. It's just been as Academic Agent would say, it's just a mechanism for the circulation of elites, effectively. But I mean, I've said this on other streams, but my position here is that I want us to effectively do what the Japanese did in the 17th century and just completely go full isolationist. No one allowed in the island, and no sort of interference with Europe or the rest of the world. That I've had enough. That's my political position from here.
Yeah, I can sympathise. All right, Darby says, are any of the modern British royals still orthodox?
Do you mean orthodox as
Greek
in
orthodox? Yeah,
or do you mean orthodox as in religiously orthodox?
Yes, religiously, because he's asking. He mentions Philip, so.
No, there are two implications. Orthodoxy is a denomination, but it's also a adherence to the religion as is. So you could be an Orthodox Protestant or an Orthodox Catholic, or you can be a member of the Orthodox Church. It's confusing.
Yeah, but, I think he means a member of the, because he says, mentions Philip, so I think he means the Greek Orthodox Church.
Well, the case of Philip had to abjure his orthodoxy, and he had to renounce his Greek titles. So orthodoxy, I'm not sure, but there are Catholics in the line of succession.
Right, okay. Clive Cutler says, fantastic discussion. Thank you very much. And Houdini says, apostolic, whenever I listen to you, I think differently. There we go. I think that's a compliment.
No, I think that is. I'm very happy that I can facilitate a different way of looking at things. I think that is very much a compliment. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, I think this has been a great stream, so thank you. All right. Well, I will be back in a few minutes with the next stream. I think it's Dr. The full name is rather unwieldy. Dr. Baron's 17th Century Shite Poster. We'll see how that goes.
And I thought Apostolic Majesty was a ridiculous name. Oh, well.
Oh, it's a great name. I love it. So in the meantime, Apostolic Majesty, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you very much, and good night.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now.
All aboard!
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word. Thank you.